Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. That far country from whose bourne no traveler returns is what we're going to talk about today. Although that's Shakespeare, and Connie Willis did not actually write that. She just put it in there.
It seems awfully terse for her to have written it.
Oh, well put. Passage by Connie Willis is the subject this week. Episode 329, by the way. We're cruising right along.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. Yeah, so Passage. So I picked this book, and I just didn't remember it being this long, for one thing.
It's very long.
It's very, very long. And I got to be honest with you, I don't think it survived a second read for me. Although the subject matter was fascinating, the end is still beautiful as I remember it. But the journey in between there, I think I was just a little less patient on. But what did you think?
I believe one could call it a hot mess.
Okay.
Now, I'm going to say that. So I don't know if I can recommend this book unless somebody has already read Connie Willis and has a real tolerance for idiosyncrasies, which are that she loves to have a very chaotic environment. She loves to have people running around like chickens with their heads cut off back and forth in the environment. There's always somebody annoying who that person's trying to avoid that makes everything more chaotic. And there are a lot of conversations that aren't quite finished or kind of just really fast. And these things make it hard when they're continually going on. They make it hard to tell a clear story. And she, the fact that she does in this book is a real tribute. And I wish she'd had an editor or somebody, but this is her style. You read it and you go, oh yeah, this is what made me have to quit reading her. Her books kept getting longer and there was more of this stuff in it. Cause I think she loves the topics that she picks. So she puts in all the facts.
Yeah. All this research and stuff.
All the research goes in. And, while it's interesting, it starts to become repetitive. You don't need all of it, you know. Now, on the right side of it, I think I would say that despite the fact that halfway through I was like, oh, dear Lord, how can I have read this book two or three times when it came out? How could I not do it now? And so I started having to skim things some because I was like, I'm never going to make it through. But I was also really being pulled through at the same time by the plot. So
yeah,
she did it. I was fascinated by this idea of the mystery of the near-death experiences. What was Coma Carl experiencing? All these other people, what they saw, what was the common thread when they were having near-death experiences? And I knew the last chapter, which is beautiful, and I cried.
Which is why I would love to talk about it, right? That's kind of it, you know?
Yeah.
If I was to summarize this novel, it'd be just super easy. There's this woman named Joanna Lander, who is a research scientist. I think she was a psychologist. And she's investigating near-death experiences, or NDEs. Mm-hmm. And she's doing it in a crazy hospital. I mean, I say crazy hospital because it's like really hard to get places in the hospital, which is part of, I don't know if that's comedic or just plain frustrating.
Having been around enough hospitals, that's how they all are.
Okay,
I don't
good.
Understand why.
It's
and
like
then also
labyrinth
the cafeteria was never open, you know, ever.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So it's really, that's what this book is. It's her, for 600 pages, exploring near-death experiences and interviewing people, talking to people, avoiding this guy, what was his name, Mandrake, avoiding him because he wasn't doing, you know, he was also investigating near-death experiences, but not correctly. And that's one of the interesting things about this. So mm-hmm. what you said was really true. It's like, I listened to it this time on audio, and this is not my first read. It's the second one, but I was listening to it. And when I was listening to it, I mean, there all the time I would just be in there. It wasn't hard to be in the book. Okay. It's just that it was so very long. It was like, so when she was having a conversation with someone who had an NDE, for example, I was riveted. I'm like, mm-hmm. okay, she's asking the questions, boom, boom, boom. I also thought it was really an interesting exploration of scientific method and how important that was to Joanna to mm-hmm. do this right, because she was coming at it from a scientific standpoint. And I thought that was pretty cool. You know, so so this guy Mandrake, he was a populist. He was writing books on life after death. And he had in his head the idea of what an NDE would include. And if he got to a patient first, he would lead them in his questioning to get the answers that he wanted. And then now that person was ruined for Joanna's research, who was doing actual research, you know. I liked that kind of thing, you know, just talking about science. I think that mm-hmm. that's a statement in science itself. And
because I think that was an interesting contrast with the third scientist who's involved, who is, I'm not kidding, Dr. Wright. It's spelled Wright, but everybody's always talking about how cute he is. He's very mm-hmm. nice, obviously.
And he's always interested got food in Joanna. His pockets.
Yes, and he always got a lot of food in his pockets. I don't understand when he pulled out a bottle of milk and like, who's carrying milk around in their pocket? But okay.
Yeah.
So everybody's laughing and calling him Dr. Wright, and we could talk about a couple of the names in the book later. But
sure.
He is interested in NDEs because he is looking at it as simply a chemical experience.
Mm-hmm.
Why does your brain experience these things when you have a near-death experience, and the number of people who remember things or don't? And so it occurred to me when I was thinking about this, we're never really told why Joanna's interested, are we? She's just interested.
Not that I recall.
She just wants to know what's the common thread.
It's a fascinating subject to look at, I think, is where she was at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've got those three scientists, Dr. Wright and Joanna want to, or Richard, let's call him, mm-hmm. they want to do it properly, study it, see what they can figure out, and Dr. Mandrake's in there just messing things up.
Yeah, he just wants to write books, and he's coming at it from a spiritualist side, where he's like, yeah, people are going to see an angel. They're going to see a life review. They're going to, you know, these are the mm-hmm. the list of things that are going to happen. And I'm looking for validation, you know.
Yeah, and he wants to prove the existence of heaven as exactly. well as writing a popular book.
Yeah.
And actually, I want to mention Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World podcast.
Ooh, I love that. I love that podcast.
Okay, so I'm trying to remember which episode it is. It might be like 302 or something. He's got a whole episode on near-death experiences.
Oh, excellent.
And I hadn't re-listened to it for this, but the essence of it is he's like, I think it's a real thing. They haven't, nobody's proven or disproven, but there's enough evidence to that's different from what you expect that it could be something.
Yeah, yeah.
And so just if people want to listen to that, if they're interested in that kind of thing, he's good at looking at the pros and cons. Yeah.
I'll drop a link for sure.
Yeah.
And,
I would say that's really it. And the book is one of the things that was so interesting about the book also, now that I've trashed it from the beginning, but other than the watching her try to solve this mystery, is the characters, there are some characters who are just delightful.
And I'm going to just jump in and say, I completely agree. You know, Connie Willis is really good at these characters. It's just that it's so long that we're seeing them sitting on stairs in a hospital stairway, you know, talking about food. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. You know, I believe the thing could have been half as long and just as interesting.
I agree. Yeah. But it's also, though, unusual to have a book like this, I think, because she talks about, she's really looking at death, memory, how our minds use symbols and metaphor to sort things out. What can we trust about what we remember under such stressful circumstances? And also then things like wrapped in around all that are, you know, friendship. So, which is part of what some of these delightful characters are.
Yeah. And relationship in general, I would even say.
Right. Yep. Exactly. Relationship mm-hmm. in general. So it is, if the style doesn't bother you, or like Scott, you don't mind going, I'm in the book when I'm listening, I might as well listen. Or like me, if you get frustrated with it, you can skim a fair amount and you're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. You can kind of tell while you're looking at it, or you may just love it. You know, the style may not bother everybody.
Yeah, yeah. But this is interesting here. In Wikipedia, there's a little section on background. The Wikipedia entry on that. Passage. Yeah. Yeah, and it says Connie Willis's inspiration for Passage came in part from her mother's death when Willis was 12. Willis felt frustrated that relatives and friends tried to comfort her with platitudes, and so she wanted to write a novel that dealt with death honestly and could help people understand the process of death and mourning. And there's a footnote where that came from. And then it also says the character of Maurice Mandrake was inspired by Willis's anger at psychics and mediums who take advantage of vulnerable people. And yeah. And that's definitely what he was doing. It's interesting that she was inspired by this. And I love, you know, friends tried to comfort her with platitudes. I mean, there's that famous mm-hmm. C.S. Lewis quote where, you know, I think it was in A Grief Observed, where he's like, don't talk to me about the consolations of religion or I think you won't understand.
Yes.
You know, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's always been a perplexing thing. You know, well, you know, she's in heaven or, you know, it's just like, my goodness.
And hopefully so. But, you know, it stinks for the rest of us. We're stuck back right. here without them.
Exactly. And they're. They're not ready when that is said. At that moment, that's not the right thing to be. You know, they've got a process to go through. You know,
right? And she's got a wealth of characters who experience death in a lot of ways. So you've got the emergency room nurse who is her friend VL, who sees it all the time. She's fighting it. She's trying to help save people. You have, you know, of course, Joanna and Richard are studying the near-death experiences, so they're hoping people come back from it, but some people die. You've got Kit and her uncle? Yeah, Mr. Brierley. Who he understood how to help her when she had that horrible sudden death occur in her life. And, you know, so it's being examined from a lot of angles. Like I say, I wish a good editor had another pass at it, or that she hadn't been so famous. I think this is the problem she had with that book. Is it called Dark Out?
Oh, Blackout and All Clear.
Blackout.
Yeah, so
Blackout. And it was
twice as long as this one. Right.
And it was in two parts, and I read the first part, and I was like, I simply do not care what happens, because she was so passionate about World War II and England and what everybody went through, that the whole book was just full of these details. It was like her flood of excitement. And I was nowhere near that excited. I knew most of this stuff already.
Yeah.
So
she's written about the Blitz so often. Yeah. She's done it a few times.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the book.
But that's the book. Yeah. So we're definitely just going to, let's talk about it and not worry about spoilers in any way. I left it at 4 stars on Goodreads, so I still just, the subject and all the things that were in it still add up to me to a really worthwhile book. It's just long, you know.
It's just a struggle.
It's just long, you know, with, and it does, you know, at times you're just like, come on, you know, can I skip this part or what? Like, you know, so
she's talked to Maisie 20 times already. Yeah. I mean, I love Maisie.
And I love Maisie. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kind of love her. And I think, you know, there's something to that too, a little bit. It's like, you know, if it was half as long, Maisie would only have appeared half as much. And I did love the Maisie bits, you know, you know, so there is that. You get to spend time with Maisie, and that might make it worth it. Well, Maisie was fun. Yeah. I loved her. Yeah.
And I actually even liked Mr. Brierley, who has Alzheimer's, so he can be frustrating, but he's an important clue.
Right.
What's going on, because as Kit says, he's got his certain logic. You just have to make the connection. It's hard to figure out the connection he's making.
Yeah.
And so sometimes he's speaking coherently in a way that Joanna can understand and kind of go, why is it that when I had the near-death experience, you were in it?
Yeah.
Why are people saying, let's check with Mr. Brierley? Somehow her brain knew way down deep.
Yeah, and let's talk about why Joanna had a near-death experience of her own.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Let's go ahead.
So that was part of what Dr. Richard Wright was doing. Is, again, he was a neurologist, so he's like, hey, this whole thing is just your brain firing off and all this stuff, and we should be able to induce it. If I'm correct, we should be able to do that, right? So he's come up with a way to do that, and Joanna became a subject where he put her under, or whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
And
all their subjects dropped out for one reason or another.
Yeah, right. And, so she was left there, and she said, I'll do it. So, so she has just a very interesting experience, and she ends up, she sees a dark tunnel, which is a common thing in the NDEs, and she walks down there. On the other end of the tunnel is the Titanic, of all things, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's the RMS Titanic, and she's on it, and it's going down, and she's walking around, you know, just seeing, and she sees Brierley. Yeah.
Eventually.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. It's interesting because she has enough of them that you start to learn all the signals. Don't turn around to look behind you, because once you go back down that passage or even look down it, you're going to kick out of the NDE.
Yeah.
So why is that? So all these things that seem unconnected, like Mr. Brierley's bad communication, are important in the end.
Yeah.
For her to be able to stay in there longer and find things out. And one of the things that I thought interesting, too, is that her experiences didn't necessarily, the length of time she felt like she was in the near-death experience didn't correspond with the real world.
Right.
And so they're also trying to figure that stuff out. And I was like, oh, what interesting clues.
Yeah, and she was... very interestingly, she would be on the Titanic and she would see things, and then she would come back and she would research it, sometimes by talking to Maisie, who was very much into disasters, and learn that some of the stuff she saw that she apparently didn't know was actually real. You know, so the Titanic did have this thing right here. It did have a mail room or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was struggling there. She was like, am I really there? You know, so she's trying to figure all that out. And that was really interesting.
Yeah, because that part of the scientific method was also interesting, because Richard was having none of it.
Yeah.
He's like, no, I think this is something you've seen or heard somewhere. I think, you know, you're going to have more proof. And so the interesting thing, too, is she's interviewing all these different people as you go along who've had near-death experiences, some falling into line with, you know, I saw an angel or old relatives or whatever, and some going, oh, yeah, Mr. Manderley was here, or Mr. Mandrake was here. What an idiot. Here's what I saw, you know.
Yeah.
And so... she, though, as a scientist, is really focused on, can I see something that has a name on it? Can I find any actual proof that is undeniable that shows that this is happening to me? And she's starting to interpret other people's NDEs as, you know, that could be that garden. This person said there was a restaurant that was done up like a big garden. I wonder if we're all having the same experience, if we're kind of really sent to a real place that somehow we're all seeing different pieces of. So she unconsciously, even though she's not letting it change the results, I guess, but she's unconsciously starting to become a little like Mr. Mandrake in that, or Dr. Mandrake, in that she's so focused on trying to see if they're actually in the same place she is. She's starting to possibly interpret things through her eyes.
And every now and then she'll get in an interview with someone else and she'll start asking the leading question, you know,
yes.
Did you see this? You know, it was like she just couldn't wait for it just to come out. She had to prod. And the thing is, while she was doing it, she was like, oh, I'm ruining this, you know?
Yeah.
And all this stuff is in her head. And that's part of what is either maddening or endearing about Connie Willis is that, you know, all of these dead ends, you know, like, could it be this? That's followed. And no, it's not that. Could it be this? You know? And so Joanna's got all these ideas and you hear all of them, you know, that's like, there's just this constant churning from Joanna, manic almost, right? You know, and and I was actually listening to the book, and it's like you're tense.
Yeah,
you're like permanently tense for 600 pages just because it's like chaos, and she's always in a hurry. She's always rushing somewhere. There's always something in her way, and that kind of stuff. But yet she was trying to stay with the scientific method, and she was trying to do that. Even when she wasn't, she was like aware of it and thinking, oh, I'm not doing this right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm no better than Mandrake. But she was trying to unravel this, her experience, and trying to explain her own experience, which was different than she thought it would be.
Yeah, because one thing I really liked is that once she has done the NDE experiment and kind of experienced some of that uncertainty about what's going on, you can't really pin anything down. And everybody keeps saying, was it like a dream? They're like, no. Everybody says, no, it wasn't like a dream. You knew you were there. You never skipped around in timelines or places. But she begins to have empathy for the people who've had NDE. So Mrs. Woolham, who had always seen a garden and said, oh, that Dr. Mandrake is an idiot, you know. She finds out she's died and she says, oh, I hope she wasn't afraid.
Mm.
And she hopes she was in, she goes, I hope that beautiful garden was real. You know, and then there's someone else where she was kind of doing the same thing. She was listening to somebody describe just a little while later, oh, and it was beautiful and there were angels and this and this. And she goes, I hope it was real. I hope that you really saw that, because she's now starting to understand what the people are experiencing.
And wondering herself, like we said, wondering herself if it's real.
Yeah. So did this book, did all that talk about death bother you?
Did it bother me? No, it didn't. Did it bother you?
Not until the end, where you have the sequences where she's really dead, which I think is a bold move. You're 2/3 of the way through the book and you kill your main character.
That was bold,
But she's still in the book because it's her real death experience. So
Joanna actually gets stabbed in a by like a drug addict in the emergency room. She's just in the wrong place at the wrong time and actually is killed. And so now she's experiencing an NDE and beyond an NDE.
Yeah.
Because she actually passes away.
A DE. A death experience.
Right. so she's dead, but she's still in the book.
Yeah, because some of it is the familiar stuff from the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
But she has also figured out by then, right? That it's all a metaphor.
Yeah. She's figured out, my understanding is that she figured out that what the NDE is the brain's attempt to, basically kick on anything that it can kick on, or it's sending out messages, right? It's like heart start, lungs breathe, you know, but it's like sending out all these messages. And then that was what she kept saying. It's a message. It's a message, you know, and that's what Byerly was trying to tell him. And what she's experiencing with her senses inside the NDE is this metaphor. So the Titanic was a metaphor for SOS, right? It's like, this is a situation, we're going down and we need to broadcast and we need to try to do that.
Yeah.
And then the idea is, if any of these signals do get through, heart start or whatever, that they actually, that's when they pull out of an NDE and return. Yeah.
And this was the thing, this was the supremely... thing that made me so tense was, I know she's going to get stabbed. I know she's going to die. But I also know she's racing through the hospital trying to get a hold of Richard, going, this drug, this is an SOS. This is an SOS. And she's trying to say it, even as she's dying, it's so important. And no one's hearing it right. And no one's interpreting it right. And I'm like, oh no, this is just killing me.
Oh, that drives you crazy. Yeah.
Yes. But the one suspense. Of the things that she realized from Mr. Brierly was that, the whole thing, your brain is also at the same time, what you're seeing is its attempt to kind of communicate, you know, it's telling the heart to start, but the brain is always thinking.
Right.
And you're always seeing what's going on. So it's like, it's a metaphor.
Yeah.
And so when she's talking to Mr. Brierly, and this is on the Titanic. And he says, well, what is a metaphor? Anyone? And she says, a metaphor is a figure of speech that likens two objects. Wrong and wrong again, he said. The likeness is already there. The metaphor only sees it. And it is not a mere figure of speech. It is the very essence of our minds.
Yeah.
As we try to make sense of our surroundings, our experiences, ourselves, seeing similarities, parallels, connections, we cannot help it. Even as the mind fails, it goes on trying to make sense of what is happening to it.
Mm-hmm.
So this, she sees, is why people aren't seeing the same thing, but it's all got that same essence, as you're saying, the SOS, the message. And but then what she starts to wonder later is, but can the symbol be the thing itself, or the metaphor?
Yeah, and when she said that, it made me think of, you know, the myth that's true.
Yes. But anyway,
go ahead. Yeah, keep going.
No, that's exactly what I was going to say is, so now you're hitting into religious territory, which is where the symbol is the thing itself. So this is the sacraments. They are a symbol, but they are also efficacious in actually doing what they say they're doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, baptism really is giving you the Holy Spirit at the same time as it's a symbol of casting off sin, you know, washing clean.
Yeah.
And, you know, all that, it's doing it at the same time. Mm-hmm. So it's that double meaning. And in that sense, the NDE, what she's starting to wonder is it doing more than just a metaphor and the chemical reactions? Because she always felt like it was more than Richard, who's just like, oh, and then this chemical reaction does this, which made me think of, you know, people who are really, really wed to the scientific way of looking at the world. They still don't say, I fell in love because I saw this person at the right time for these hormones to kick off.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I married this person because the chemistry was really right. That's all there was, you know? That's
chemicals.
That's not it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I love that.
Yeah, and I think later on in the book, and of course I may not be able to find it.
While you're looking at that, while you're looking for the next thing, this is a paragraph that's not too far away from what you just read.
Okay.
But he's like, oh yes, he said, not even slackening his pace. Water is a symbol too. The thin line of water was growing wider as they neared the end of the passage, becoming two, then three rivulets. That's an interesting thing right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the crossing of water has been a symbol of death since ancient times, Mr. Brierly said, stepping easily between the rivulets. The Egyptians journeyed to the land of the dead in a golden boat. So, yeah, it's really interesting. You know, all the things that water symbolizes to the Christian.
Yes, I hadn't even caught that. That's great. Because she also talks about, why does she see the Titanic? Hold on. All these different disasters. And why is she seeing the Titanic in her NDEs? And she says, Mr. Brierley had been fascinated by the Titanic. And that's the connection that she made that kind of led her back to him. Is it, this was in a book I saw. And he read it to us. And she said, what had Mr. Brierley called it? The very mirror image of death, which is why it had resonated down through the years. All disasters, Maisie's Hindenburg and Pompeii and the Hartford Circus Fire, had some of the attributes of death, its suddenness or its panic or its horror, but the Titanic had them all. Courage and destruction and casualness and a dreadful confluence of coincidence and culpability, terror and gallantry and despair. The tragedy of the Titanic was both sudden and slow, the impact with the iceberg as unexpected as a car accident, as a stroke. But it was also endless. The passengers sitting quietly on deck chairs after all the boats were gone, or playing bridge in the smoking room like patients in nursing homes in the oncology ward waiting to die. All the attributes. The injury that seemed minor at first, a lump, a shadow on the x-rays, a cough, nothing to worry about. Modern medicine has made the ship nearly unsinkable, and the captain surely knows what to do. And I thought about that, and I said, oh my goodness, you know, having now been around enough older people through doing my movie groups or just living with my mother and going to the hospital with her and all these things, you're just like, oh yeah, it's sudden and slow at the same time. At some point, it's just sudden and it happens.
Yeah.
But there are all the things leading up to it.
Yeah, that's a nice connection. Mm-hmm. We've had some, like my wife's dad passed away not too long ago. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. It was slow and fast at the same time.
Yeah, it happens. And then you got to sit around and wait and try to figure out what to do. And there's really often nothing you can do, but everybody likes to think there is.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, when you were asking, did this book bother me? I asked you, and then you said, did it bother me? It bothered me, like I said, at the end, because she didn't know what was going to happen. And so sometimes she was just floating. She was going, oh, just amongst the fireflies. Oh, those are like SOSs. They used to call them this. And so she's putting all these things together, but everything's kind of falling apart. She can't remember this or that. And that's when I was like, I feel like this feels too real to me. I know she probably talked to somebody who guessed what it must be like, and she interpreted that through literature, literary terms. But I had to stop and remind myself at one point, she's making this up. We don't know that that's what that's like.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Because those sequences of episodes were kind of disturbing. You're totally out of control. You don't know what's going to happen. And you don't know where you're going to wind up. I guess that's, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know where you're going to wind up. And she doesn't have any faith. Joanna? She believes in science. Yeah.
Right.
And science alone.
Yeah. And that's why, I mean, the end, the very end. But you still like that, how that ended?
I love it.
That's good. Yeah.
Who could not? Right. And in fact, I kept looking at it throughout the book. I would see little clues of things. And so I'd come back and read the last page again. And every time I read it, I was close to tears.
That's nice. Yeah. Yeah. Would you like to read it?
Can I read it?
Please.
Yeah. So a big ship's coming up. It's in her mind. It's her and this little girl named Helen and a bulldog. She's a French bulldog who she saved. And they're all kind of floating around on this raft going, we don't know what'll happen. And they're hoping a ship will save them, but they don't know. And they see one. Is it the Carpathia? Helen asked. No, Joanna said wonderingly. It's the Yorktown. The Yorktown, Helen said. I thought the Yorktown sank in the Coral Sea. It did, Joanna said. She could see the wireless shack now, high up on the island. And the antennas shaped like crosses. and was raised again in 3 days. What's it doing here? I don't know. How do you know it's the Yorktown if you can't read the name? Helen said, but there was no mistaking it now. She could see the planes, sailors lined on the railing of the flight deck, their white uniforms blindingly bright. Do you think they'll see us? Helen asked. Maybe we should signal them or something. We have, Joanna said. SOS, SOS. She stood up and faced the ship as if it were a firing squad. Are we saved? Helen asked, looking up at Joanna. I don't know, Joanna said. This could be some final synapse firing, some last attempt to make sense of dying and death, some final metaphor. Or something else altogether. She looked up at the sky. It was changing again, deepening toward them, the York tossably huge, impossibly fast, its narrow prow cutting like a knife through the shining water. Are you scared? Helen asked. The Yorktown was nearly upon them. Flags were flying from the tower and the masts and the antennas, and on the flight deck, sailors stood at the railing waving. In the center, the captain, all in white, held up a pair of binoculars and looked toward them, the lenses glinting gold. Are you? Helen demanded. Yes, Joanna said. No. Yes. I'm scared, too, Helen said. Joanna put her arm around her. The sailors were shouting from the railing, waving their white hats in the air. Behind them, above the tower, the sun came out, blindingly bright, gilding the crosses and the captain. What if it sinks again? Helen asked fearfully. The Yorktown went down at Midway. Joanna smiled down at her, at the little bulldog, and then looked back to the Yorktown. All ships sink sooner or later, she said, and raised her hand to wave in greeting. But not today. Not today.
Mm. Beautiful.
You could say I was going to lose it several times during that.
Well done. Yeah, but yeah.
Yeah,
the whole book leads up to that moment, and man, yeah. Is that just full of
it's symbols, powerful.
Right?
Well, yeah, there's the crosses. It's blindingly bright. The sky's turning gold. It's the captain's coming to get them. The sailors are all cheering and waving and shouting at them.
In white uniforms.
You made it. It's heaven.
Yeah.
Salvation, it's redemption, it's whatever you want to call it. And yeah. It's all the more powerful for the fact that the only person who mentions religion, other than some of the people predisposed to it who have NDEs, is Mr. Mandrake.
Hmm.
So it comes out of the blue for her, so to speak.
Yeah. Right. It comes out of the blue for Joanna, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, because she's still like, oh, this must be my synapses firing.
Yeah, it could but be the synapses firing. It's like, but it might yeah, be there's something more.
Amazing going on right here. And yeah, it was just a beautiful touch at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's also touched on when Maisie is having her NDE. And what is it? Emmett Kelly helps her out of the circus tent that's on fire.
Yeah.
And later she's kind of puzzling her way through it as she's talking to Richard. And she's going, well, you know, Joanna said symbols can also be really something else. And she goes, and it wasn't Emmett Kelly who saved me. It was Joanna.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, because.
Yeah. Even when she met Emmett Kelly in the NDE, she was telling him right then, you're not him, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, it was really good.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah, I love it. It's it's the thing that made the book worth reading.
Yeah, that's what stuck in my head all these years later after I first read it was the end. And I was like, you know, that'd be interesting to talk about. And it's worth it. Then just the last page. It's amazing that's one page after all of those pages.
Well, that's the thing. And it's got, it kind of opens all these questions up, right? About how do we think about death? How do we prepare for our death? Because as Catholics, we're thinking about, we should be thinking about it a lot. Not in a morbid way, but just knowing this is coming, and there's death, there's your judgment, and there's heaven or hell, and then the final judgment. Well, I guess the final judgment,
yeah,
heaven
right. or hell. Mm-hmm.
So we're gonna get 3 out of the 4.
Yeah. You know, that's an interesting thing, you know, because in RCAA, you know, when we have someone who comes, you know, there's always that first meeting and there's always something on their mind, you know, that, what they want to talk about. But every now and then someone starts with that. What happens when we die is their first question. And that's interesting to me. It's never why I came, you know, or became,
right,
you know, or was converted or what, however we want to put that. But for some people, that's what it is, you know. They're like, I need to start with this. Can you explain this to me?
Mm-hmm. And whatever's happened in their life that makes them think,
right,
I don't know about this thing.
Right.
Yeah.
It's always an interesting thing.
Yeah, and I never think about, I mean, I think about death only in that I'm striving towards being the best I can be with the grace of God, because I just want to be that person. But that's also what you need to be when you die.
Mm.
You know, yep. If you're really, really good and you're fully cooperating with God and everything, you're an actual saint. The rest of us wind up in purgatory,
yeah,
where we are saved, but we got to finish.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't worry about that. I mean, I don't look forward to the process of death.
Yeah.
That scares me, but I don't think about that because I can't do a thing about it, and I have to trust that Jesus will be there.
Right.
With me.
Yeah.
I mean, the promise is we're not alone.
I agree with that too. Yeah, and I just don't think about it that much. I don't know why,
mm-mm,
but it's never...
No.
You know, when I first started doing RCA and I was teaching it, you know, so you do a class on the four last things. And I had to look all that up and learn it. It's like, you know, I had been in the church for a long time and it's like, oh, I never really looked into this that hard. And because, yeah, it just wasn't foremost in my head.
So in this sense, in this book, there's, you know, the metaphor for heaven is this big ship coming to rescue you, and here's the crosses and everything. So this is how Connie Willis is using it, and it works for the book, of course. But it made me also think, do you ever try to imagine heaven then, since you don't think about death?
Yeah, but I don't know. It's like I can't imagine it really as a place.
Mm-hmm.
So what I imagine is being in the presence of God and what that means, you know, that is where I get into the awesome, you know, and I think about it, you know, it's like, I don't know if you ever do this, but when you think about infinity, or when I do, I think about infinity, I always get to a point like my stomach kind of flips and I'm done thinking about that.
You know what I mean?
Like, yeah. And it feels the same way to me. Like when I try and think of what, it's almost like I don't have an image. It's a feeling. It's like, what would that be like to be in the presence? And it's not like I see some big bright light or anything.
No, because he's a person, personal.
It's a feeling, yeah. And and it just feels infinite, you know?
Well, I try not to think about infinity because it just hurts my brain. But what I think, when I think of heaven, and I don't actually ever try to imagine it, I have a friend, a really good friend, who really surprised me when we became really good friends. She would talk about, and I just wonder if heaven's like this. She'd do it all the time. And I'm like, I think you need to stop thinking about, I don't think somehow that's, you should go, I'm just so curious. And I was like, it will come in its own time and it's going to be nothing like we can possibly imagine. Just like a baby doesn't understand what the world's going to be like. Right. Yeah. But when I think of heaven, the things that people have said that have gotten me excited or interested or thinking that is going to be so cool are the things like one time during a Bible study and our priest, we were all having this great conversation, getting really going on everything. And our priest said, and this is what heaven's going to be like. We're all going to have this flow of ideas and everything and we're going to be excited about it. And we're all going to be learning together and doing stuff, you know? And I went, wow, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, I think about Jesus himself used the metaphor of the feast, right?
Mm-hmm.
The best party you've ever had with all the people that you know or should have known.
Hmm.
And you're all still yourselves and different, but you're all on the same page.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that sounds like a lot of fun to me.
It does.
I can't imagine it going on forever, but that's my finite brain going, well, you just can't think big enough. And then the third thing I think of, and I think of this one the most, is Dante's Image of Heaven, where it's almost like a huge stadium and everybody's sitting around, you know, and there's empty seats and everything. But this is where Dante sees Beatrice, who's like smiling at him and nodding and then looking back at the center. And the center is where, you know, God is. It's the rainbow, and you can see the three figures, and one of them looks man-shaped, you know?
Yeah.
And they're all so fascinated. Mm. They're just looking at it. And so it's like there's some other communion that Dante couldn't convey, of course, but I like the promise of that picture.
Yeah, that is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like that, you know, some type of communion going on, which is, yeah, exactly right. You know, there with the cloud of witnesses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But mostly it's that I can't imagine hell. I mean, I can't imagine. I know that people, they say, you know, you pick hell because you can't stand the thought of being near God, which I can't also wrap my mind around. And I'm so glad I can't. And I'm not trying to be mean about anything. Mm-hmm. It's just, I'm like, to me, to know that God was somewhere and I was cut off from him would be the worst torture, because my greatest desire is to be with him.
Yeah.
The few little tiny glimpses I've gotten on earth, the few little moments of going, ooh, you know, that's you. And, you know, a bit of communion. I'm like, how could you even give that up? So that's the really different mindset that you can have that would say, no, this would hurt too much.
Yeah.
I couldn't stand it.
Yeah, that would be really difficult. I, you know, can't imagine. But well, yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
We don't have to ever know that.
Hopefully not.
So. But then it just made me wonder because, you know, she clearly was picking the ship symbolism and did a beautiful job with it.
Yeah.
That the antennas were shaped like golden crosses. And, you know. And
yeah, there was it was beautiful. And she is, yeah. She is Christian. She's, according to Wikipedia, she's Congregationalist. At least she sings in a Congregationalist choir. She says that you can learn everything you need to know about the world in a church choir.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
That's really funny. I wonder if that's where she gets some of her characters.
Oh, maybe so. Maybe so.
Yeah.
Yeah, because her characterization is terrific.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I'm sure she did more things in there than I slowed down to read this time or would have noticed. But so we talked about Dr. Wright and the spelling of it. But also a mandrake is a powerful narcotic, can be used as a sedative or a hallucinogen.
Very good.
So Dr. Mandrake's name, of course, was carefully chosen. And Maisie means pearl.
Nice. I love that.
Yeah, and yeah. Viol means
Pearl
violin.
Pearl, great price even.
Yeah, exactly. Worth fighting for.
Yes.
Like when Richard is going, nope, you've always been a good at stalling, Maisie, when she's having her NDE and she can hear his voice still. It's like, stall. Mm-hmm. Give us more time for this drug to work and kick you back.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
And that was the other thing I loved. Joanna was talking about, you know, Gilbert or Sullivan who died saving somebody from death.
Hmm.
And she said, that's how I'd want to die, saving someone else's life. And she does. She saves Maisie's life. Not only Maisie sensing her, although she's seeing her as the Kelly.
Yeah, Emmett Kelly, I believe.
Yeah, yep. Emmett Kelly, a clown character. But the fact that Richard took the SOS thing and correctly interpreted it and took it seriously because he knew Maisie was the person that Joanna would have wanted to save most of all.
Yeah.
And set everything up so they could save her however they could. And they did.
Yeah, that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So well done, Connie Willis. At the end, anyways. Let her rip. That's awesome.
Well, she got there. It was she got a bit there. Of a slog. It was
great.
Yeah. If she didn't write so many of her books this way, mm-hmm. I would have said it was very cleverly done, because all this chaos and the dead ends and the just the mess going on everywhere is almost like it was for Joanna to try and figure out all the clues of what the NDEs meant, mm-hmm. or for Mr. Brierley trying to grope back to reality through his Alzheimer's so that everybody can make the connections. In that sense, the way the book is written, if you want to look at it that way, it is reflective of what's going on in people's minds at the time.
Very cool.
That way. Unfortunately, that's her writing style. So that's just, you can't really say that, but for this book, you can say it.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's what it's going to be. That's good.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you for looking at this with me again, though.
Oh, yeah.
So her latest book is called The Road to Roswell. And it's a a comic novel about alien invasion, it says.
Okay.
A delightful novel about alien invasions, conspiracies, and the incredibly silly things people are willing to believe. Yeah.
Well, I read one of her recent comic novels about somebody... Was it a device that would allow you to read people's minds, or just some people who had the ability? And it was also a comic novel. The problem was it suffered so much from this same sense of repetition and disconnection and frustration that I could only get through about half of it. I could see where it was going, and I wanted to like it, but I couldn't.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess she's just now, for me, an author that I just can't.
Mm-hmm.
Do it. Her early books I liked, but
yeah. I may try the Roswell one someday.
Yeah,
it
yeah,
says Publishers Weekly says an absolute blast with abundant humor, copious references to old westerns, and a delightful intergalactic twist on the romantic comedy.
Okay.
So yeah, we'll see.
Well,
sounds like it could be a movie. Good movie, anyway.
Yeah,
that sounds good. Right there, you bet.
I'll take it.
Yeah, an Indian movie. Oh, what was that one where the guy was an alien?
PK.
Yeah, PK.
Yeah, right. Just like that, with just some songs and dances. Yeah, exactly.
Some item numbers.
Yeah,
I love
an
it.
Item number. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oh, that's too good. That's too good. All right. You know what's interesting is when this. And this was unintentional, but this is coming out the day after the Titanic sank.
Oh, wow.
The Titanic sank on April 15th.
Oh, my gosh. And
this will go out on midnight of April 15th. Isn't that funny?
My goodness. Yeah.
It's a metaphor for something.
Or it's a symbol.
It's a symbol. It could be a symbol.
I kept saying symbol, and I really meant metaphor, but maybe everybody will forgive me. Well, and also what I was thinking is we put off talking about the movie. Isn't Soul coming up?
Yeah, Soul is the next one, yeah.
Right. Isn't that interesting? And we put off talking about it, right, because my mother was in the hospital. I just couldn't find the time, and you very smartly said, you know, we could let this go.
Yeah. We only have 328 episodes to choose from.
That was it. And I was just like, I was ready to talk about Soul, but I was like, this is good because I cannot literally find an hour right now when I could do this.
Yeah.
But to put Passage next to Soul, which is also about death and birth, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah.
How funny.
It's kind of, it'd be a good pairing.
It will be. Yeah. Looking forward to that. So we'll talk about that in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
So, good. Excellent. Well, thank you for listening, everyone.
Yes. And, thank you very much.
It's still Easter time as we record this. So happy Easter.
Happy Easter.
All right.
It's only in the middle of Easter. Not even in the middle.
Not even.
That's what I love about Easter. Easter is so long.
It keeps going.
Great.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Okay. All right. Take care, all.
Yeah. Talk to you again soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.